Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. If you're listening on 1120, you can do better than that by listening on 87.9, right?
I thought it was 90.
Now I'm
confused.
98.7.
98.7.
Yes. Yeah. 98.7.
Yeah.
People have been on 87.9 like, you liar, there's nothing here.
They'd be like...
I know this because I took radio into my mom's hospital room, her rehab room, and it's on KMOX and it runs 24/7. But that's normal because my mom is always listening to KMOX 24/7. And
nice.
I'm not kidding. Like, overnight, she had like this little pillow speaker that she would listen to it and help her sleep. And so it's very nice. I was listening. I think Ackerman does a Sunday thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My mother-in-law does the same thing. She listens. She has the radio on even at night because it's comforting to have the noise, and it's always on KMOX.
Yeah, very sweet. Yeah. Attorney Chet Pleben joins us. A lot going on between Donald Trump and the Supreme Court. Chet, happy Monday to you.
Well, thanks. Same to you, Dave. And hello and happy Monday to Mrs. Glover. She's listening.
That's very sweet. Thank you. She probably perked up right now. She's like, who said that? Someone's in here and they know my name. Okay, let's start on with Donald Trump. Did the day bring anything so far, or maybe over the weekend?
Well, yeah, there was no court today, but certainly last week, David Pecker, who ran the National Enquirer for America Media Incorporated, spent 10 hours on the witness stand over a period of 4 days. And he did some damage to the defendant. It started off with him establishing that in August of 2015, he was invited to a meeting over at Trump Tower. He met with Trump, Michael Cohen, and that's when the plan to catch and kill or use the National Enquirer to catch and kill derogatory stories about Donald Trump during the course of the campaign. The whole idea of that was to take those stories out of the public domain so that the campaign would be helped. He testified all of last week that he was a friend of Donald Trump. He's been a good friend of Donald Trump since the 1980s. And frankly, that outside the courtroom was also acknowledged by Donald Trump. So the question now, because he did some damage to the defendant, the question is, well, how are they going to handle him on cross-examination? And essentially, what they attempted to do was to impact his credibility. For example, he testified that at one point that Trump actually thanked him for handling the doorman and McDougal. The doorman, the National Enquirer, paid $30,000 to keep him quiet, because he was contending that Trump fathered a child out of wedlock. And of course, Karen McDougal was someone that allegedly he had an affair with for a considerable period of time. And the National Enquirer paid her $150,000. So after the election, Trump thanked David Pecker, his friend David Pecker, for taking care of those very potentially embarrassing situations that could have impacted the campaign. So obviously that testimony is pretty devastating, coming from a guy who's been his friend since the 1980s. Yeah. And so they have to do something to counter that. And so what they said was, well, wait a minute. You talked to the FBI, and you never told the FBI anything at all about being thanked by Donald Trump for taking care of these two situations. I think Pecker just responded by saying, well, that obviously, if you're reading from an FBI report, that's somebody else's interpretation, perhaps, of what I said. Hmm. So it turns out that on redirect, which the prosecution is allowed to do, they get up and they say, wait a minute, they show him another FBI report where clearly he says, yes, that Trump thanked him. And it was on, I believe it was a trip that he went to the White House after the campaign was concluded and after he won the election and he was in office.
Hey, Chad, can we do something sort of in the weeds here a little bit? Because, you know, people are fascinated by attorneys and trials, and most people know it only from television and movies. And we all know that cross-examination is where you win the case dramatically and you crack someone. Can you talk a little bit about how many cases are lost during cross-examination because you ask stupid questions? Or because on you open up something that on redirect they come back and just slay you?
Yeah. Never, ever, ever ask a question that you don't know the answer to. And there are a lot of ways to find out answers. You can take depositions, you get police reports, you get all that sort of stuff. So the question that you ask on cross-examination, you better know what the answer is. And if that witness deviates from that answer, Then you can use whatever document you have, whether it be a deposition or a police report or whatever it might be, to contradict that person. So that establishes a credibility issue, and that establishes a situation where that client has now fabricated something that's pretty important to the case. So all juries, you know, obviously, somebody is going to give one position. Somebody else is going to give a different position. And so at the end of the day, the jury has to make a determination as to who's lying, who's not, who's credible, who's not credible. And one of the ways that you do it is through effective cross-examination. Now, the counter to that is what these lawyers did in asking David Pecker about a question that they thought they knew the answer to, but turns out they really didn't, because apparently they only read one report and didn't read the report in which clearly he told the FBI that Trump thanked him. So that's a pretty important thing. And so when lawyers do that, you lose the jury's looking at that and says, well, wait a minute, you just suggested that he never said that. And there wasn't anything that Pecker could do at that point in time because they had the documents. Pecker's on the witness stand without documents, and so he doesn't have it. So he says, well, you know, okay, that's one person's opinion. But then the jury looks and says, well, wait a minute, you knew or you should have known when you asked him that question that there was another document. And so, you know, was that a little sleight of hand? Mm-hmm. And did you think that you were going to slide it, you know, past us and bad news?
One more question, because you've tried so many cases and so many cases that lasted weeks. Talk a little bit about how important it is that the jury's view of the attorneys, whether they like one attorney or they don't like one attorney, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, juries usually like the lawyers, generally speaking. They may not like the client, but they generally like the lawyers. Now, there's a caveat on that. You know, if you get into, and a lot of these lawyers representing Trump got into disputes with the judge. So the judge, the juries, you know, 12 people are looking at, they're not professional lawyers. They're not professional persons. So they're looking at that judge for guidance. And so they look at that judge as, you know, he's the fair and impartial arbiter of what's going to come in and what we're going to hear. And so if you get into an entanglement with the judge that they like, then that's not going to bode well for you in the long run. And so everything then from then on, probably that you have to say, they're going to view suspiciously, potentially. Mm-hmm. So it's important that you behave yourself in that courtroom and that you not get into those entanglements. You know, and effective cross-examination, you know, can be hard. I mean, you can go at people very hard. You have to make a determination, too. Obviously, if you're cross-examining, you know, a kid or a younger person, you go a little slower. And you can make your points. If you're cross-examining somebody that's pretty rigid on where they are, then you can go a little stronger. So you kind of have to take the temperature of the witness that you're cross-examining, the judge, so that you don't get a bunch of objections sustained on the questions that you're asking, because that generally doesn't fare well for you either in the long run of things. And so it's all a system of you know, kind of playing it by ear, yeah, and making a determination. So some of these, you know, some of these lawyers, I mean, I feel for them because they're compelled because of what Trump is telling them to do.
Yeah.
You know, you got the tail wagging the dog. So a lot of this stuff they do only because Trump is pressing them to do it. Not in Trump's interest.
All right, brother.
He does.
We'll talk to you tomorrow, I'm sure. Thanks, Chet.
You bet.
Welcome back, guys. DGS221. Wheels, I know you had some stuff on the Google Doc about the protests in Gaza and what's going on at the university, so take it anywhere you want.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we had some of those protests at WashU this weekend, which was interesting because for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, they seemed to take pretty quick action, if I'm reading it correctly, right? Where these things have been going on for days at other places. I think, just a little while ago, the deadline passed at Columbia to where they were going to say, you got to clear out or there are going to be repercussions. I mean, at WashU, what I'm seeing is they're already suspending some of the students for not following directions, for not leaving when they're told to leave. Because keep in mind that a lot of these are public, these are private schools.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a different standard for a public college and a private college. It's a private, you know, business, essentially. They get to make the rules. And if they say you have to leave or there's going to be consequences, you have to leave. And again, it's a lot different thing than when you're on public property, public land.
I hadn't really thought about that angle.
Yeah. So that's what's happening at a lot of these schools. USC is a private school. People don't know that, but USC is not a public school. Obviously, the Ivies are not public schools. So they're starting to come around on this. Hey, listen, you know, first of all, there's a, I don't know if you saw this too, there's also a lawsuit now that's been filed, I believe, against Columbia for not providing a safe campus for all of the students. And I believe one of the Jewish students filed a lawsuit saying, listen, I've been threatened walking around campus. There are people that are shouting terrible things at me. And essentially the response has been to suggest that the Jewish students stay away from campus. Well, that's not really, you're not helping them get their education. So that's the basis for the lawsuit. Like, hey, listen, you're not doing what is required of you to make sure that all of your students are safe. So there's been a lot of this stuff going on. And it really is. I know we talked about it briefly last week, and we don't need to relitigate, you know, the actual argument here. But what's fascinating is they're trying in the cases of like Columbia, and I think maybe that's what they're trying to get at WashU too, is trying to get the investment arm of the schools. What is
yes,
it? The what do you call it?
Diversify
the
endowment.
The endowments to step away from anything related to Israel and Israeli, I don't want to say government, but businesses, like businesses that do business with Israel, which is almost impossible, and most of them are refusing. And at what point, I guess, this is where I would ask you, because this is what happened at WashU, for example. Almost all of the police officers that were available in at one point over the weekend were called there, so they were nowhere else in St. Louis because we're obviously understaffed, which yeah, is a completely separate topic. But to the point where this happening is literally making the rest of the city unsafe or less safe, and it's obviously a private school, but they're going to have to call in public resources.
Yeah.
To take care of this problem, how do we act on that?
Go ahead, Rachel.
I thought I had seen, like, on Reddit and Twitter that it was just WashU police taking care of it.
There was I saw some stuff. Again, it's Twitter, so maybe
right. Yeah, it's
not
so
100%
hard to know
accurate,
true.
But there were requests for more help.
Okay.
Am I wrong? And if so, how? In that, my view would be just let them do what they're going to do and have the natural repercussions of it. And if you want to live there, you're going to miss graduation and other people are going to miss graduation. And that's because of your actions. We're not going to drag you out. If you want to stay here, we're asking you nice. We're negotiating with you in good faith. But if you're going to refuse, we're not going to call the police. We're not going to drag you out. We're not going to make a spectacle. You get to have your way. You get to sleep in a tent on campus and you get to ruin everyone else's good time. Like, that's kind of the way that I think I would approach it.
Yeah.
I feel kind of like a sissy doing it that way, but it's more like you're going to get the natural consequences of your actions. I would also push back intellectually and say the things you're asking for are kind of babyish.
Right. You're being children, right?
You're being children.
You're being manipulated is what they are.
And you're being very, very naive because, look, do I understand $2 billion endowments? No. Do I understand that kind of investment strategy? No. But did you see the pantheon of companies that they want them to stop doing any sort of business with? It's literally hundreds.
Yeah.
Hundreds of companies.
Yeah.
And I would try to make the point that, look, you're not being grown-ups about this. We understand your position. We understand your passion. But what you're asking for is not in our power.
It's ridiculous is what it is. And I would say that the counter that I'm hearing, because obviously I'm not involved in it, but the counter that I'm here, and we'll use our daughters, and I'll use my daughter Shannon, your daughter Phoebe, as an example. If they were the targets of violent speech, if they were the targets of, let's just call it aggressive behavior, not necessarily physically aggressive, but people screaming at them, shouting at them, making them feel unsafe in the middle of their own campus, what would our expectations be of that university? I would expect the school to protect all of the students.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the pushbacks against letting them have their way from parents. Mm. And then there are also other parents saying, well, hold on. Why should we not get the moment of seeing our child graduate because you're going to continue this? And I guess that's the whole point, right? Your freedom of speech ceases to be your freedom when you are impeding the freedom of other people. That's kind of one of the lines we've drawn as a country. You have the freedom to do what you want until what you're doing is stepping on the freedoms of other people. And that's that delicate balance that we have to deal with at the moment. And then there's also the larger picture, Dave, I think would be a really good point to follow up on your idea that they should also be taking an educational role in this, in sitting down with them and saying, yes, here's why we cannot do what you're asking us to do. And then on top of that, well, are you going to ask us to stop doing anything, any business with any company that does business with China because of their human rights violations, or Saudi Arabia or Qatar or anywhere else in the world where people are abused by governments? Because if you're doing that, you will have zero investments anywhere, right?
Yeah. No, you're right. Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. My next guest is Bethany Hughes. You may know her from her multiple television shows. I'm a big, big fan. She has Genius of the Ancient World, Genius of the Modern World. She has a great series on the Nile. She's a scholar at Oxford and has taught at Cornell and Bristol. And she joins us now. Bethany, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for being with us.
Lovely to hear your voice. Nice to meet you.
So I have to tell you this story of how you're here. So as I say, I'm a really big fan, and not just a little fan. Like, I'm nerding out because, like, I watch your stuff all the time. And Andrew told me today, because we have a 4-hour talk show, he told me today, hey, we have an anthropologist on and she seems really great. And she's written a book about the 7 wonders of the world. And I'm like, yawn, whatever. And then he tells me her name's Bethany Hughes. I'm like, how interesting. I know someone named Bethany Hughes. And he goes, well, here's what she looks like. I'm like, oh my God, that's Bethany Hughes. And so I'm really excited to talk to you. I'm a very big fan. So tell me about your new book.
Oh, that's why it's all great to hear. Yeah, well, I'm very excited about the book. So as you say, it's the story of the 7 ancient wonders of the world. And everybody's heard of them. We all know about the Great Pyramids. But it just struck me that people all think they're myth or fantasy. They are all real. They're all places that the ancients used to travel to. And they were basically not just a list. This was a kind of bucket list, so that these are places that everybody wanted to go to see. So I thought I'd do this mad thing of like go on my own travelogue adventure and travel to them all and find out all the new archaeology about them and then write a book about it.
So you have seen more amazing things than 99.9% of the people on Earth, because that's what you do. It's your vocation, your avocation, and your passion. Does it just never get old? Every time you see something new, is the tingle just as strong?
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, and it can be a tiny thing. It can be one tiny bead. So I was outside the Great Pyramid recently and looking at the space where all the workers who built the pyramids, where they lived and what they ate, and the fact they all used to share these like kind of massive like vats of bread and of beer together. And there was a tiny, 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 tiny blue bead that had obviously been dropped by one of them, whether they were using it like for barter or whether it was a necklace that they'd worn that had broken when they were working on the pyramid. And I picked that up and nobody has touched that for 4,500 years. And it's electric. You know, it's totally, I mean, it's just talking to you now. It's such a privilege to be connected back to all these other lives. I think that's the thing about history. It's not about dead stuff. It's about lives and, you know, people who've had incredible experiences. So, yeah, you're right. I never lose my excitement wherever I'm out there on the history hunt.
So, Bethany, obviously you don't know the mind of every person out there watching or listening, but would you guess that we know more about the Seven Wonders? Let's just take, for example, the Great Pyramids, that we know more about them than most average people out there who aren't into it like you and I are, that we know more about them than they think we do?
I think so, yeah. And if I write a book or do a tele program, I basically become obsessed with the subject. So anybody I meet, whether it's a taxi driver or a stranger in a bar or somebody on a train, I'll stop them and say, okay, so what do you think about this subject? And so when I talk about the Seven Wonders, it's really, really interesting to me. This, I always say, what, you know, do you know what they are and have you got a favorite? And 99 times out of 100, the one place that people will say are the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Mm-hmm. They go, oh, yeah, you know, Hanging Gardens of Babylon, aren't they one of the wonders? And it's a huge irony because, first of all, we don't know exactly where they were, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. They're the only one of the seven that we don't have hard, fast evidence for, like their remains, their ruins, their fragments. And also, we don't know whether or not they existed at all, because we don't have this, you know, we don't have a kind of massive old kind of, you know, basically kind of window basket that's been left in archaeology. But because of that, that's why we're fascinated by them, because I think we all love the idea of gardens. They sound very romantic. You know, it's this mm-hmm. exotic allure of the East. So we kind of can imagine them in our heads. And that's one of the reasons that they've, you know, they're still alive for people. So it's a really interesting thing. These are ancient remains that we think we know the Seven Wonders.
So with the pyramids, we had this discussion. I'm here with my co-hosts, and guys, we had this discussion last week.
Yeah.
Remember when I brought up, why don't we do anything like this anymore? And of course, we build amazing skyscrapers and we have the space shuttle. We have a helicopter on Mars. I'm not saying we're lazy. I'm just saying that we don't do things like this anymore. And Bethany, when it comes like the pyramids, you can say, well, there was this guy who thought that he was the embodiment of the living god Ra, and he wanted a really cool place to be reincarnated. I understand that. But there are other things that were built outside of that paradigm. What do you think it was about these people going back thousands of years that they were so drawn to building these amazingly giant, unbelievably complicated things?
Well, yeah, I mean, and you're right. If you think about the pyramids, you know, it was built 4,500 years ago. It's still standing pretty much intact. So the engineering there is just incredible. It's still the heaviest building ever built by human hand, which is staggering. So we've never managed to you know, replicate that. And it's, I mean, it is, I don't know if you've been to it, but it's just, if you stand at the base of the Great Pyramid, you cannot not feel anything other than awe at the building and at the people who created it. Well, that's what's so fascinating about particularly the ancient past, the kind of classical past, is that people are very intense in the way that they approach the world, because frankly, most people are dead by the age of 40. So you've got these kind of very, very short lifespan to get things right. And I do think that's one of the reasons that everybody is like fired up and buzzing and the synapses are going. And then, you know, they think we've got to get this right now because who knows what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, I'm sure when I was writing the book, I was also thinking, I'm sure there were like these sort of ancient equivalents of planning committing meeting rooms with people all going, you what? Yeah. You want to build a colossus, you know, a statue that's 108 feet yeah. tall. You're bad, you know. So there must have been naysayers as well. But yeah, no, they were very incredibly resourceful, you know, and they're doing all this just with a flat rule and a compass, you know. They're not, yeah. they haven't got loads of complicated equipment. But yeah, it is very, it's very moving being in the presence of these things and incredible thinking about them. But they built them, basically, the Seven Wonders list is a list of the seven biggest of everything. So size yes. really matters with the Seven Wonders. So, yeah, so they're important things.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Bettany Hughes, who is a scholar and an author and a TV presenter and now my best friend. And so one point I want to make, which seems like an obvious point, but like when I was in Rome and I saw the Colosseum, gosh, 30 years or so ago, it hit me like, oh, it didn't always look like this. It was brand new at some point. And for example, the Great Pyramid of Giza, most people don't realize that the outside was covered in this white limestone and a gold cap on top. And so you could see it shining from miles and miles away. We always think of these things being dilapidated from the start. They were even more breathtaking multiple times so.
Yeah, definitely. You're absolutely right about the Great Pyramid would have shone out like some sort of sci-fi arrival in the desert. And it would have been reflected in the Nile as well, because the waters of the Nile were much closer to its base. So it would have been kind of double height. And a lot of these classical buildings, so the Statue of Zeus in Olympia, the Temple of Artemis in Ephesus, and the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus, which like has given the world, all mausoleums are based on this original one. They would all have been exactly as you're saying, not sort of tasteful whites, you know, slightly distressed marble. They were all painted really bright, gaudy colours, like oh, you know, reds and golds and peacock blues. So there'd have been like a kind of fairground mm-hmm. when they were made originally. And we know that people used to talk about them because everybody wanted to visit them. So basically the Seven Wonders lists are kind of guidebooks, you know, they're saying, oh, you can go and see the Colossus of Rhodes, but don't stop at that particular bay because the pirates will nickel your suitcases, you know. So people really did go to see them. But also when novelists, ancient novelists, there's this great guy who's basically the world's first sci-fi author. And he writes, and this is 2000 years ago, he writes a novel about a Greek astronaut going up into space and looking down on the Earth. And the only reason he realizes that it's planet Earth that he's looking at rather than all the other planets is because he can see the Colossus of Rhodes and the Lighthouse of Alexandria. So, you know, we know that for those people, they were like the kind of defining symbols of human achievement.
So, Bettany, you've seen so many things. Is there one that stands out? Is there one gasp of walking into a room or walking upon a wonder that really stands out among the others?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's hard, isn't it? It's like picking between your children, you know, it's kind of impossible really to have a favorite. I think if I can, probably two. So one is the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, which I love because it's the least famous, but I think it would have been the coolest really, because it was like a massive sanctuary for people who wanted to seek help and refuge. So I'd have loved to have been there. And it was a huge kind of dating site as well. So it was a very romantic place. Mm. And also the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus, because I've been lucky enough to climb down 30 feet into the earth in Turkey, where the mausoleum is, to see another tomb built by King Mausolus that's only just been opened. And it's actually making my mouth water describing how beautiful the statuary and sculpture was. And this would have been exactly the same as the sculpture on the Lost Seven Wonders. So I think probably those two, they might not be the obvious ones, but I think those two have stolen my heart.
So will there be a television show to follow up the book?
Well, it's just, I'm delighted you asked it. We've just heard this week, yes, there will.
Excellent.
So I know, so really, really exciting. So I'm heading out from August. I'll be getting back on the Nile on a boat and crossing the Mediterranean, you know, between island, hopping between Greek islands on the Trail of the Seven Wonders. So yeah, so that will be coming to the States probably spring next year.
I love it. So the book is The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, and Extraordinary New Journey Through History's Greatest Treasures by Bettany Hughes. Check out all her other stuff. I'm telling you, just the Nile series is so great, so cozy. It's just such a great watch. I watch it many, many times. Bettany, it's wonderful to meet you, and we'd love to have you back on when you hit television.
Oh, gorgeous. Yeah, that'd be lovely. Talk to you. I'll come and see you when I come to the States. We can geek out over ancient history together.
I love it. Thank you, Bettany.
Okay.
Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye, 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 bye.
Bye-bye. I think that went really well. I think it's going to be okay.
Dave, so people don't know the behind the scenes. Like when we have interviews, Dave will give me a look or Rachel a look or Andrew once in a while. Like, do you have a question you'd like to ask? And I was like, yes, but I don't want to because you're having so much fun.
Yeah.
I didn't want to get in the middle of all that. You guys, that was great.
That was great.
Yeah. I mean, I knew what those things were. We all kind of do, but I'm going to watch the show for sure.
Oh, you should. She really, like, crush having aside, she does a really great job. And it's really beautifully shot. Okay, I can't do a live right now. I'll do it after the traffic, if that's okay.
That's fine.
A little bit too excited.
Coming up on the show, we have Stairway to Kevin. We have Dave Murray headlines. We have the Think Tank Today with Jeff Rainford and Kurt Barr. And I was just kind of crapping on other television commercials during my Window World or my Universal Windows Direct. And you know the one I hate? I hate the ad for the company that has the regular dog food, like the food, when their whole thing is like, they're always kicking someone out of a camper or they're breaking up with a girl. Have you seen this? Because they're like,
I have seen this.
What's this in your refrigerator? They're like, oh, that's food for my dog. They're like, dog food in the refrigerator? And they're like, yeah, it's regular food. And they're like, it's just a dog. And then they like shoot them in the heart or something like that. I hate commercials that make the person you're marketing to look like a freak. Like, it's one, it's like, I get the joke. I understand where you're going with the boys. I get it. But, like, you went too far because you're making the dog owners look like straight up freaks who are never going to have a human interaction.
Yeah, I've seen the breakup one, and he says to the dog, like, it was never going to work out with her anyway. It's like, because she was surprised that the food was in the fridge.
Thank you.
Is she that much of a villain?
I don't
understand.
Exactly.
Probably not best to make your target audience seem crazy.
Exactly. I'm so glad you guys agree. I'm going to text Bettany and see
what she
thinks.
Although we dog people can be a little bit.